welcome to a one-year special marking the 400th anniversary episode of Travel Witch Radio. I'm your host, Dan Schlossberg, along with my friend and co-host, Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee. This is the 10th season of Travel Witch Radio, the show that lets you enjoy the pleasures of travel from the comfort of your armchair. And tonight, our five special guests, all repeat visitors to the show, represent a tour company, an attraction, a museum, and two warm weather destinations perfect for a winter getaway, Florida and Arizona. We're going to go fast, limiting each guest to about 11 minutes, and we have a lot to cover in the next hour. So let's get started. A warm welcome to Tony Mua, owner-operator of A Slice of Brooklyn Bus Tours.
Hey,
Tony,
Dan,
when
how
I
you doing?
Tony, when I think of a slice of anything, I think of pizza. But I hear A Slice of Brooklyn blends a slice of pizza and a slice of local history. For listeners who don't know Tony, please share.
Oh, thanks, Marilyn. Well, again, congratulations to you guys on this anniversary. And as far as A Slice of Brooklyn, what I wanted to do is to combine the foods, the neighborhoods, the landmarks, the movie locations that made Brooklyn famous. And so that's why, I mean, you could certainly go on a four-hour pizza eating tour that's just pizza or 4 hours of just history. But I wanted to mix it up and really focus on, you know, a little bit of everything. And it seems to have really been something that people have really loved since day one.
As someone who's taken your tours, Tony, I not only love the stops, but the film clips that you show on board. You show clips from the many movies made in Brooklyn, like Scent of a Woman and The French Connection, just as you're passing that area. How does that work?
Well, basically, if for me growing up in Brooklyn, you know, it was like growing up in a movie set. So I grew to love these movies and the locations. So what I did was create an audiovisual program. So on the screens of the bus, as we're we use it for slides and music just to enhance the experience overall. But as we pass the respective movie locations, we show the clip up on the screen. And for many people, Brooklyn means different things. It could mean pizza. It could mean the Dodgers. But for a lot of people, they know Brooklyn from TV shows and the movies. And sometimes I love when I see somebody who's a little bit, you can't tell if they're having a good time or not, but you're about an hour and a half, 2 hours into the tour, and suddenly you take them to see where the French Connection chase scene took place, and their eyes light up like a kid on Christmas morning. And so it really does something for folks who only knew Brooklyn through the movies or TV shows. It really puts them there right in the center of everything at that moment.
It sure does. And since Grimaldi's is so famous, do your groups have to wait in the long lines there?
No, actually, absolutely not. No, we have an arrangement with them. And normally the line at Grimaldi's for our pizza tour can, you know, it can go all the way down the block. But we have an arrangement. Okay. We go right past the line. And so people on our tours feel like they're VIPs as well.
Is your family involved in A Slice of Brooklyn?
Originally, it was just myself, Dan, when I first started. After 20 years in healthcare, I changed gears and started, and it was just by myself. My Uncle Louie actually used to come and help greet the folks in the morning because he worked at the post office nearby. All our tours depart from Manhattan, and he worked at a post office close by. And then in 2007, after I appeared on the Today Show, we started getting bookings like crazy, and my cousin Paula came back to business, and she's been with me ever since. I started in 2005, and she's been with me since 2007.
I love the comedy routine on your tours, Tony. Where did you learn so much about Brooklyn history?
Well, you know, I think growing up, like many of us, you're just proud of where you're from. You know, there's a certain pride, and you learn the history. It's in you. It's always some kind of conversation piece. And then it was one of those things that other people, you know, just fell in love with as well. You know, it's all about that. You know, that's I'm a storehouse of useless trivia, I used to think to myself. And here I was able to finally put this trivia to good use.
Now, Tony, don't you also operate chocolate and Christmas lights tours?
Yes. Yes, Mary Ellen. Yeah, we actually do a chocolate tour of the popular chocolate places in Brooklyn, from Jacques Torres chocolates to Lilac to Rocca to the Chocolate Room. Our Christmas Lights tour features the famous Christmas lights of Dyfer Heights, which is now known around the country and around the world for the beautifully decorated homes. We have a Best of Brooklyn tour where it includes a full sit-down lunch at the original Juniors on Flatbush Avenue. And we were going to start a new tour last April known as the Brooklyn Brewery and Distillery Tour. So we're really excited about that one.
Oh, wow. How has the pandemic impacted your operation?
Well, sadly, we haven't done a tour since last March. We're actually coming up to a year now without tours. Luckily, I never owned the buses. I rented them. It was never a brick and mortar location. This was a home-based business. So basically, kind of just we're in sleeper mode, so to speak, because there's no tourism and no one's traveling and it isn't really safe right now. So, in fact, that brewery and distillery tour that I mentioned to you, we were supposed to launch last April, and it was March 9th that we did our final tour. So, but I'm staying optimistic, and I'm hoping that, you know, this industry really is able to bounce back, you know, once it's safe again to travel and to do so.
Oh, I hope
Tony, so. I know that you pick people up in Manhattan and bust them over to Brooklyn. Why do you do that?
Yes, sir, because when I started in 2005, there were just a few tours, and they were walking tours, and they were asking people to come to Brooklyn. And look, you know, 2005, people were not jumping on a train and coming to Brooklyn as easily as they would now, or feel as safe as they would now that Brooklyn's become a hot destination. Back then, it was sort of still under the radar in the shadows of Manhattan. And for me, my whole feeling was, well, if I want people to experience it, you know, we should really pick them up in Manhattan. You can't say meet the bus in Brooklyn because, you know, most people don't know their way around and never came to Brooklyn before. And I wanted to make it easy. I felt, you know, you have to go where the tourists are. And so that was an important step. I also knew that I wanted to cover everything from Dumbo, which, as you know, is northern Brooklyn, just across the Brooklyn Bridge, to all the way south in Coney Island. And I mean, that's the total opposite end of Brooklyn. And so there was only one way to do it, was with a bus. And like I said, as long as we had the vehicle, it seems silly to ask folks to come to Brooklyn. And that really has worked out really well for us, the fact that we go to Manhattan and pick them up.
For listeners who might not know, Dumbo means down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass. And you make
exactly a
stop, we can get great pictures of the Brooklyn Bridge and the Manhattan Bridge. Really a terrific stop with all the cobblestone streets, a terrific area there.
Oh,
so you don't
absolutely
stop at pizza places, you stop there too.
Folks can get like the best photo of the – people don't realize the best photos of the Brooklyn Bridge are actually on the Brooklyn side in Dumbo. There are no highways there. You're literally standing just below it. You feel like you could reach up and touch it. Funny story, I once told somebody they wanted to know what – you know, we explained what Dumbo meant as we were coming over the bridge. And I repeated. I said – she goes, what is it? What was that again? I said, down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass. And she goes, well, you don't really need the O part, the overpass, do you? And I go, well, then it would just be dumb, wouldn't it?
That's true. And by the way, you cover something like, what, 50 square miles, and sometimes it takes 5 hours?
It's a 4.5-hour tour, 5 hours if it's, you know, if there's traffic, which, you know, of course there's traffic. Especially in summertime. But yeah, I think we cover about, like, it's about 35 to 40. I mean, like I said, we cover one end of Brooklyn to the other. As soon as you come over the bridge, overlooking the East River to all the way south in Coney Island on the boardwalk, overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. It's no other tour covers as much as we do in the time allotted.
And I got to tell you, Tony, I thought I knew a lot about Brooklyn. I'm a lifelong resident of the New York metro area. I thought I knew a lot about Brooklyn until I took your tour. And I didn't know anything about Brooklyn compared to what you know.
Well, that's kind of you to say that, Dan. You know, that's, we just wanted to create an experience where even if people, as I say on the tour, you know, at the beginning of each tour, I always say, you know, we're going to teach you things and show you stuff about Brooklyn that even Brooklynites don't know about the place, you know. And the feeling is that we want folks to feel like a friend or a family member is taking them around and introducing them to places and giving them VIP treatment and showing them how to greet people with the old, how you doing?
Yeah, okay, Tony. So what's up next for a slice of Brooklyn? And do you think things will be more normal by our mutual birthday on May 6th?
Well, either way, I will be toasting both you and myself on May 6th. for our birthdays.
And
but
Willie
I
Mays,
don't know.
Too. Willie Mays will be 90.
And that's right, the Say Hey Kid. That's right. So, for me, I'm staying positive that things get back to normal. Certainly with the warm weather, we expect things to improve. But I'm really excited to finally be able to launch this brewery and distillery tour and then continue with our other tours as well. And the plan for the future is to just have other tours like, a tour of the best bakeries in Brooklyn, an ethnic food tour of all the different ethnic neighborhoods as well. So the future looks really bright.
Thank you so much, Tony Muya. Of
yes.
A Slice of Brooklyn. And please tell our listeners how they can find out more.
Oh, it's easy. Just go to our website, which is A Slice of Brooklyn, all one word, aSliceofBrooklyn.com.
Perfect.
That's great, Tony. Thank you so much. And unfortunately, your time is out, but now we're going to talk about railroad. I love things on tracks, trolleys, trains, Lionel, you name it. So next up is Sue Presby of the Mount Washington Cog Railway. As I mentioned, I love trains, but this one is special. It started right after the Civil War, and it's still going strong. So how about a little history, Sue?
Hi, Mary Ellen. Hi, Dan. Thank you so much, and congratulations on this great anniversary. Well, the Cog Railway was designed and built by Sylvester Marsh, who was famous for the meatpacking industry, actually. He is a New Hampshire native. And in 1857, he and another gentleman decided to hike Mount Washington, which happens to be the highest peak in all of the Northeast at 6,288 feet. And that mountain is known for the world's worst weather. And, of course, they got caught in a bad snowstorm and almost died. When they came back down, Sylvester Marsh said, you know what, there's got to be a better way to get to the top of this mountain. So he went to the New Hampshire legislature, and he tried to get a charter to build a railroad up the side of the mountain. He not only got the charter, but he also got the nickname Crazy Marsh. And they felt that it was an impossibility, so they not only gave him a charter to build this railroad to the summit of Mount Washington, but they also gave him a charter to build a railway to the moon, because they figured that was just as likely to happen. Now, the train that was to be built, because the elevation, we have an average of a 25% grade going up the mountain, so the regular train that people think of that rides on the rail was not something that was going to work. So we had to have a center rack, and think of it like a bicycle chain. So there's a center rack, and you have teeth, which is the cog gear, and that propels the train up the mountain. So the engine pushes the train up the mountain. The passenger coach is in front. The engine is behind. So in 1866, he started cutting down trees and building this railroad. And July 3rd, 1869, it took its maiden trip, and that it became the very first mountain-climbing cog train in the world. Not in the United States, not in New England, but in the entire world. And we just celebrated our 150th anniversary last July 3rd and had a big party. So, yeah, we're starting our 151st season right now.
So
and if I remember correctly, the track is 3 miles long and takes, what, almost 3 hours to get to the top?
It's a three-hour round trip. You were right on the first part. It's a 3 mile up, 3 miles up, 3 miles back down. The original trains that went up the mountain were steam coal-fired steam, and those have run until 2008. We still have coal-fired steam, but we have a really talented crew at the COG. And when I say old-world technology, it's kind of an oxymoron, but we design and build our own engines. And in 2008, we built our first biodiesel engine, and since then, we have built seven. So the steam engine took a three-hour round trip because it took about an hour and 10 minutes to make the trip up, because it could only go about 4 miles an hour. And on the way down, it went a little bit faster. So it was an hour and 10 minutes up. You had an hour at the summit, and then it was about 45 minutes on the way down. The biodiesel engines go at a solid 6 miles an hour up and down, so it's a very consistent speed. So it takes about 40 minutes to get to the summit. You still have an hour, and then it's about another 40 minutes down. So it's still between 2.5 and 3 hours for the round trip.
And do you still run the steam engine on the first run of the day?
We do. We don't run the steam engine all year round because once the weather, we don't, in the springtime when we first open, we don't run it. Once we get into summer, we run the steam train, and we do it until usually like right after foliage when it starts getting cold, we stop running it. But what we have done is we experimented this year with running the steam train, not only as the first train of the day, but running a steam train in the afternoon, a steam train late in the afternoon. And that seemed to work. And, of course, this year everything was a little bit, you know, discombobulated because of the pandemic. So I think we're going to be running the steam train again in the afternoon, but we will be running the steam train in the morning.
So with the cold, snowy, wet winter in New Hampshire, do you still operate every day or do you close for maintenance?
Well, we traditionally didn't. We would close probably around the end of October. My husband and I have owned this since 1983. And we ran until like the end of October. And my husband and I have a tendency to try and extend our business and come up with new and exciting things. So we ran ski trains 1 year or 2 years, and that wasn't very popular. Then we just ran, and not to the summit. The elevation at the base station is 2,700 feet. We run to this part we call Wombeck Station, which is about 3,900 not square feet, you know, elevation. That's what I meant to say. I'm sorry. So we go there in the wintertime, and this year we decided, because everybody seems to want to be outside after being cooped up with this pandemic, so we said we'll try running again this winter. And it has gone extremely well. We've had more interest and more riders than we even anticipated, so we've been running every single day this winter.
Oh, my goodness. Speaking of weather, isn't the summit of Mount Washington one of the wildest places in the country?
It is. It's got the nickname of the world's worst weather.
What?
On the highest recorded wind speed on a machine, and I forget the name of the machine, was 231 miles an hour. And the only reason they know that it went that high is because the machine broke. So it could have been a higher speed, but that was the highest speed that was recorded. There is a weather observatory at the summit, and they take weather readings every single hour, 365 days a year. It has gotten with the wind chill, it has gotten 60 to 70 below zero with the wind chill, and the highest recorded temperature at the summit has been 72 degrees. So, and it can be quite a dramatic change from the base station to the summit. So sometimes you can be in a pair of shorts, and we encourage people to, you know, bring extra clothes because you can get to the summit. It can be 60 degrees at the base, and you get to the summit, and it's 30.
Wow.
Well, if the weather is clear, Sue, how far can people see from the top?
You can see forever. You can see 100 miles on a clear day. You can see into Canada. I don't remember. It was probably, 10 years ago when they had the fires in Canada. You could actually smell the smoke, and you could see the smoke off in the distance. You can see into Canada, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Massachusetts. You can see the Atlantic Ocean in Portland, Maine Harbor, and if the cruise ships are docking there, you can actually see the glint off of the ships.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible.
That's
it's
cool.
One of the most incredible views.
You mentioned in a message that there's lots of new cog news, so please tell us.
Okay, now this is what I'm really excited about. My father was a tool and die cast machinist, so the cog train is just like my love. My husband and I absolutely love it. 2 years ago, we decided that we were going to do a re-railing project. So it's a 25-pound rail that was the existing rail on the railroad. And starting last year, we started a re-railing project. First, we had to build the re-railing car. So we have this 33,000-pound re-railing car that has an open center in the bottom, and it's got electricity, it's got heat, it has welders, it has all the tools so that everybody, the guys that are working on the track, are completely contained from the elements. So they can work 12 months out of the year on track maintenance. So we built that 2 years ago, and we use that. This year, we have just about completed the change from 25-pound rail to 100-pound rail. We've got a very small portion that's left at the summit just because of the weather. It snowed early this year, so we don't have that done. But the biggest news for me is that we are in the very, very final final stages of building a 35,000 square foot maintenance facility, which will allow us to put our trains inside there, do all of our work, because I don't know if I mentioned it or not, but we build everything right at the railroad. We build all our engines and all of our coaches. And if any of you are listening and are interested in incredible craftsmanship on woodwork and on actual machining, come and take a look at these trains. I know, Dan, you've been on the trains and you've seen the woodwork that is done in our shops, and it's absolutely beautiful. In this new shop, we have two 10-ton overhead cranes. It was 600 cubic feet of concrete that went into this. We have air casters, so that we have the tracks are on air casters so that we can move things around if we need to. So, yeah, that's what's been going on during the middle of a pandemic.
Where exactly are you located, and are there good places to stay nearby?
One of the best places to stay by, and it's staying in the whole theme of history, is 6 miles down the road from our railroad is the Omni Mount Washington Hotel. And that is where the World Monetary Conference was held in 1944 at the end of World War II, where they set the gold standard. It's a beautiful old grand hotel. There is also basically a bed and breakfast on property, and there is a motor lodge across the street. That's right in Bretton Woods. Where the cog is, it's approximately 3 hours from either Montreal or from Boston. And from Boston, it's a straight shot right up Route 93. It's a beautiful drive. There are a lot of chain hotels in North Conway, which is about an hour away with traffic. You've got some bed and breakfast. You have a lot of bed and breakfasts, cute bed and breakfasts in both Sugar Hill, Littleton, Franconia. Whitefield, there is the Mountain View Grand Hotel. So there's a lot of great, beautiful places to stay in the area.
Okay, you've got to tell our listeners, Sue, how people stand up straight on the train, only they don't. They stand at an angle,
you.
Don't they?
Right. When I said we have a 25% grade is the average grade. There's one point in our trip. It's called Jacob's Ladder, and it is the second steepest grade in all trains in the world. We're at 37.41% grade, which means ours are 70 passenger coaches. So when the person sitting in the very front seat of the coach stands, their seat is 14 feet higher off the ground than the very last seat in the train. So if you want to envision it, think of the ski jumpers that you watch in the Olympics when they go off of the jump and their head is basically right over your toes. If you stand up in the aisle, you look like you're bent over, but you are actually standing straight, but it's the elevation of the train that gives that optical illusion.
When I was a boy, I loved playing with my toy trains, but yours is full size. How did you get into this?
Well, that's an interesting story. Believe it or not, my husband and I are both lawyers. We met in law school. He graduated a year ahead of me and came, and he is from this area. His family has been here since the 1600s. And he purchased the train with another gentleman. I went on to Massachusetts and did divorce law and family law. Wayne and I kept in touch, and lo and behold, I figured out that doing a tourist train was much more fun than doing divorce work. Wayne and I got married, and so it is. And 27 years later, we're still enjoying every minute of it.
Oh, that's so lovely. How do listeners get more information about the Mount Washington Cog Railway, Sue?
They can go on our website, which is www.thecog.com. And on that website, it's going to have some great history. It's going to show the rail cars. It's going to show the new shop. It's going to talk a lot about how we built things. And I know we're going to be doing shop tours when we get the shop done. And our goal, we would like to be able to do some internships, because let's face it, mechanic and all this stuff is becoming a dying art. And it really is something that we really need to embrace.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks to Sue Presby of the Mount Washington Cog Railway. You're listening to Travel Itch Radio 400th episode, a one-hour special with Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent Lee. Listen live on iTunes or blogtalkradio.com or check out the archive show on our Facebook page. Now, since we are all snowy and freezing in the Northeast and just talking about New Hampshire, we need to warm up. So we're headed due south to St. Augustine, Florida. Welcome, Barbara Golden of Florida's Historic Coast.
Hi, my friend Dan. How are you?
We're doing great. Mary Ellen, it's all yours.
Okay, good. Hey, Mary Ellen. Hey, thanks for having me on, and congratulations on this 400th episode. Very proud of you.
Thank you. Very excited. Thank you.
Thank you. Barbara, tell us, where is it, why is it called Florida's Historic Coast, and what's included?
Okay, so we're called Florida's Historic Coast because we are the most historic area in North America on the North American continent. We are on the Northeast Florida coast. We include St. Augustine, Ponte Vedra, and 42 miles of beaches. This is where Ponce de Leon first came ashore and claimed La Florida for Spain in 1513. Then it settled in 1565 as St. Augustine. So you have the oldest continuously occupied European settlement in North America here on Florida's historic coast.
Oh, that's beautiful. Now, did Ponce de Leon find the Fountain of Youth in St. Augustine?
Well, the Fountain of Youth is, that story is kind of a fable. Ponce de Leon was actually looking, he was the governor of Puerto Rico in San Juan, and he had to give up his governorship because Christopher Columbus's son was actually entitled to that. So instead, he worked with the king, and he decided he was going to go on a voyage of exploration. There had been stories of these very robust natives living on these little islands. So he went exploring, and he was looking for natives to convert to Catholicism. This was during the Spanish Inquisition. They were looking for land to claim for Spain, and they were looking for gold and silver to fill the Spanish coffers. Now, because of the word about these great, healthy, robust, very tall people that were 5'8" and 5'9", and for a Spaniard in the 1500s, that was a giant. And they also lived into their 70s and 80s, and the average age of the Spaniard in those days was about 45 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where the fable got started. But the Fountain of Youth Archaeological Park that is here, he did actually come ashore there, but what that piece of property is so important, and it's such a great experience for people, is that that is the exact site where the Spaniards that came in 1565, that is where they settled, and they lived amongst the Tumuqua Indians that were the natives here. So there is rich archaeology, archaeological history, and great stories about how the Spaniards explored and settled here.
And speaking of Ponce de Leon, how big of an imprint did the Spanish leave? I know you have an old fort with cannons, many old buildings, and even a famous old bridge.
So we have right on our bayfront the Castillo de San Marcos, which is the oldest masonry fortification in the United States. It was built between 1672 and 1695. And it's made of coquina rock. And this is a fort that it was designed to protect the city because it was constantly under raid by pirates and the British, because the Spanish and the British, you know, they didn't really get along so good. And the Spanish they had been attacked a number of times. There had been 9 wooden forts that stood in 100 years, the 100 years that the Spaniards were here at that time. And they were burnt down, or termites got to them, or they were flooded out, or they rotted away. So Queen Mariana of Spain finally ordered the building of this masonry fortification. So that is our main piece of architecture, and I think our most iconic thing in St. Augustine, because you can't miss it. It sits right on the bayfront in downtown. But then you see the architecture throughout the city, there aren't really any buildings older than the fort, because at one point they were under attack and the entire city went inside the fort while they were under siege and the city was burnt to the ground. So there's really nothing older than 1703 outside of the fort. But as architecture is rebuilt over the year, it's replicated, and they stuck with the same design. They stuck with the same city plat layout. And the buildings, when you come to St. Augustine, you kind of feel like you're in an old European town, the narrow streets, the coquina block buildings. It's very much like you would find in a provincial Mediterranean town. But then in the late 1800s, we had Henry Flagler, who was a partner with John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil. He started creating the Florida East Coast Railroad. He came to St. Augustine, which is a long story in itself, and he eventually fell in love with the town and felt like they really needed fine hotels. Before he started building his hotels, they were old wooden hotels, and, you know, they would burn down. And, of course, wood doesn't do well in moist environments. So he built some beautiful hotels that are very Mediterranean and Spanish Revival style architecture. So we have not only the 16th century Castillo, but then you come into the 19th century with these beautiful Gilded Age hotels that are just opulent. And then we have a lot of influence from the Victorian, which would be our British influences. But you have more of a flavor of Spain here than anything.
Do you recommend visitors take the tram tour to see area highlights?
Absolutely. We have a couple of different options. We have Historic Tours of America runs the Old Town Trolley Tours. And then Ripley's, believe it or not, they own the St. Augustine Sightseeing Tours. And these trams do a great job of taking folks around the city. This is something I like to recommend to anyone to do, because there was 455 years of constant history here. None of it was boring, and it is very difficult to take it all in just a day or two. So my biggest suggestion is take one of those trolley or train tours around the city first. The best part about that is your ticket is good for on and off privileges around town. So you would not just get the tour, but you can use it for your transportation around town throughout the day.
Now, your area is known for beautiful marinas and gorgeous sunsets and bed and breakfast inns within walking distance of the waterfront and shopping districts. Could you tell our listeners how big St. Augustine is and how easy it is to get around?
Sure. I will tell you, the area itself, St. Augustine proper and the historic district, is 144 square blocks. And that is the preserved historic district. And there are about 26 historic bed and breakfast inns. There are several hotels like the Casa Monica Hotel, the Collector Inn. We have a new Renaissance San Marco that is opening later this spring, which is one of the old hotels from the 1800s. Renaissance is rebuilding a replica of that hotel. So we have another grand hotel coming. And then we have a few boutique hotels, all in the historic district. But more than that, just outside of town, there are, you know, affordable options with, you know, the DoubleTree and, you know, affordable chain hotels. But over on the beach, you have vacation rentals. We have RV resorts. And then all the way up to Ponte Vedra Beach, we have amazing oceanfront resorts like the Ponte Vedra Inn and Club, which is a AAA five diamond resort, and the Sawgrass Marriott Resort, and lots of golf and other outdoor activities to do to complement all that wonderful history.
Now, can visitors come in by plane, train, boat, or automobile? Would Jacksonville be the closest major airport?
Yes. So Jacksonville is about 45 minutes north of us, and Daytona is about an hour south of us. So Jacksonville has the most flight options, and Daytona International Airport also has some great flights. And both airports are, believe it or not, through the pandemic, their flight services are increasing.
Great.
So that's great. Yes.
Barbara, how do Travel with Radio listeners learn more about St. Augustine of Florida's historic coast?
You can go to floridashistoriccoast.com. That's Florida, Florida, historic, HISTORICCOAST, coast. Floridashistoriccoast.com. And there's lots of information.
Okay. Thanks to Barbara Golden of Florida's Historic Coast. Visit Phoenix is next in the batting order for our 400th episode special on Travel Itch Radio. So let's bring in my friend Doug McKenzie. Hey, Doug, how are you?
Well, good evening. How are you tonight?
We're doing great. We're celebrating here. And since baseball is starting this week, I'm celebrating anyway. Cactus League Baseball just opening this week. 15 major league teams have pitchers and catchers reporting. And isn't that a very big deal in your area?
Spring training is a very, very important seasonal activity. They are setting the games up so everyone is socially distant and safe. And so we're looking forward to a few spring training games here in Greater Phoenix.
While Florida is famous for grapefruit and palm trees, Arizona is known for many kinds of desert flora and fauna and beautiful red rocks. Can you tell us about the botanical gardens and wildlife like the lizards, iguana, javelina?
The desert botanical gardens are one of my favorite places to visit. There are different cactus that I discover every month that I go there. The rains that we had in December will now are perfect timing for the cactus that are blooming, along with our wonderful citrus trees. We have a variety of desert wildlife, and that can include anything from coyotes to bobcats to little creepy crawlers. But, they pretty much stay in the desert and mind their own business. So it's a good thing that we co-live with them.
Like Florida, there's a Spanish legacy in Phoenix too. Please tell our listeners what they can see and where they should look, including the Heard Museum.
We really have a diverse influence from many parts of Mexico, as well as our Native American influence. The Heard Museum is the largest collection of Native American artifacts in North America, and it really sheds light on the many years that the Native Americans spent here in Arizona. They have a wonderful museum, and they have a great gift shop with authentic Native American handcrafts. I like their bolo ties, quite a selection of them. And that's always a great place to visit. Certainly, many of the conquistadors traveled through our area, and we have many, many food items that reflect Northern Mexico as well as Central Mexico. I know Chef Silvana makes a wonderful guacamole with pomegranates, which is something different and very refreshing for the desert. We also have
you made a terrific presentation about tacos. So tell us a bit more about the local food, including fry bread and the Indians' influence.
We do a variety of Mexican-inspired cuisine. We have even a tequila goddess at one of our resorts who graduated from Tequila, Mexico. We have so many wonderful, authentic street taco trucks and restaurants and taquerias with everything from beef to pork to seafood to potato tacos. And that's very popular with our friends that like vegan food. So the authenticity of the local Mexican food is really stunning, and the different sauces, from green and red sauces to moles and different chilies and habaneros and jalapenos, coupled with some agave and some tasty margaritas, you have your meals all set for you.
Doug, you're making me hungry. But listen, Phoenix is also a perfect place for amateur and professional astronomers. It's called the Valley of the Sun, but there are plenty of high places where light pollution is minimal and that dark sky viewing is perfect. Can you tell us about that?
It really is a perfect place for seeing the stars. I visited with an astronomer a few months ago, and we saw Saturn and Pluto. We also have a new resort called Adaro, which is the first dark sky certified resort in the U.S., and they are located at the edge of the desert where anyone can see so many stars, so less light pollution, and with proper telescopes can see so many of the planets. I think we can even see the rover and Perseverance tonight on Mars if it's a clear night.
Oh, my.
Well, getting back to Earth, I love the light rail system that starts at the airport and fans out into the community. Do visitors need cars, or can they rely on your ultra-modern streetcar network?
Our light rail is very convenient, with miles and miles of access that stops at our Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. And it's a deal where you can't say no. It's only $4 a day for unlimited travel. So you can take the light rail to different communities, especially in downtown Phoenix. We also have bike rentals, our grid bikes, and then explore the neighborhoods and the murals with your bikes. So the light rail is an easy, fast way to get into Phoenix from the airport and tour our many districts and neighborhoods.
And Doug, your area is known also for sprawling resorts like the Phoenician, my personal favorite, and you're right next to Scottsdale, which includes the Old Town District. With so much to see in Greater Phoenix, how long should people stay?
Well, I think they should stay, you know, really a few weeks. But if you're limited on time, I would say there's so much to see in under a week. The pool, all the resorts have wonderful pools and spas, and you can play golf. There's so many outdoor activities, which are so important in this pandemic. We have had outdoor patios and outdoor restaurants for many, many years, so that's not new for us. So that's a wonderfully safe route to go for dining. There's so many hiking trails, to go horseback riding, to go kayaking, and explore our very lovely Sonoran Desert is certainly a safe way to visit and see our destination.
Now, with the summer weather almost hot enough to fry an egg on the sidewalk, is winter really the best time to come?
You know, we are truly a year-round destination. The summers attract so many of our international guests, where so many of them have only seen cactus in cartoons. And with their 10 months of gray skies, they love, you know, a little warm days. The mornings are perfect for walking, hiking, golfing. And as I said, almost every hotel has a pool. And then outdoor dining at night when the sun sets, with a gorgeous sunset, you can still dine outside. Also, summer is our value season, where You can bring the family and extended family and find some wonderful, wonderful rates at our luxury resorts that are sometimes nearly half of what they would be in the wintertime. So there are certainly advantages to spending time with us all year round.
And as a major metro area, doesn't Phoenix have all the major sports, both professional and college?
We do. We have all of the major sports, Coyotes, of course, the Cardinals, the Suns. We have a soccer team, Phoenix Rising. We have almost 200 golf courses. Of course, spring training and the fall league for baseball. The Diamondbacks with their roof that pulls back, and the only stadium with a swimming pool. So sports is big. There's also so many Ironman and triathlon and marathon races here, since it's a wonderful location for exercise, for physical activity, and for many sports. Ping has their corporate headquarters here, where they make the golf clubs here. Wonderful golf. You can take a cart around, and one of our courses at Kierland has bagpipers at sunset.
Ooh.
They also have a Scotch library, so there's all sorts of fun things that you can do to enjoy golf and every sport.
And I know you've hosted a few Super Bowls and major golf tournaments out there too.
We just finished up with the Phoenix Open, Waste Management Open, and that was very successful. They had limited attendance, but it was gorgeous weather, and everyone enjoyed it.
Does Visit Phoenix have a free guidebook or an 800 number to help visitors book reservations?
We have a very robust website at visitphoenix.com. You can build your own itinerary. Check out all of our attractions and hotels. We have a great dining guide for all types of different interest. If you want steak or Mexican or fusion or authentic Native American food, fried bread, Mexican, seafood, sushi. We have certainly all of the information on a variety of hotels where you can stay, and there really is a price point for everyone to enjoy a good hotel visit and a pool and spend some wonderfully warm days here in Greater Phoenix. So come on out. And
okay, thank you, Doug McKenzie of Visit Phoenix. And last but not least on
so
our
much.
1 hour special 400th anniversary show is Marjorie Benders of the Mid-Missouri Travel Group. Welcome, Marjorie. How are you?
I am fantastic, and I am delighted to be with both you and Mary Ellen tonight. I think you guys are saving the best for last because you knew that I was going to lay it on thick. How proud I am to know you guys, and I just want to congratulate you on your fourth episode, your 400th episode, and your 10th season of your fabulous radio program. I'm delighted to be on this and to be a part of it.
Well, thank you. Your check is in the mail.
Okay, I was hoping so. Now, you told me, did I say it right?
Okay, when people think of Missouri, they automatically think St. Louis and Kansas City, but there's a lot in between, and that's where you come in. What destinations do you represent, and where are they located?
Okay, well, let me just tell you, I represent Mid-Missouri destinations, Columbia, Missouri, and their neighboring small community of Rocheport. We also give them a plug when we can. Also, Fulton, Missouri, and the Lake of the Ozarks Golf Trail, which is located at the Lake of the Ozarks. Where else? And I know you wanted to know exactly where is this, and you said St. Louis and Kansas City is what most people think of when they think of Missouri. Well, you know what? At this time of year and right now with everything that's been going on with the pandemic, that's probably a good thing because people are looking for road trips. They're looking at for different kinds of travel. And so what we are hoping to be able to do is put it out there that if you're looking for a close-to-home road trip or across-the-country road trip, Interstate 70 goes right through Columbia. It's about 7 miles north of Fulton. And so if you're looking for a road trip really to just enjoy yourself, then I think some of the smaller destinations and the rural areas with great outdoor recreation opportunities are going to be in high demand this year.
Isn't Columbia the home of the University of Missouri? And what else is there?
Okay, yes, indeed. The University of Missouri, as well as two other private colleges, are located in Columbia. And an interesting fact, the first ever School of Journalism was actually started and developed at the University of Missouri, and that's well over 100 years ago. So we're very, very, very proud of that. But and the campus of the University of Missouri, the entire campus has been designated as a botanic garden. When people come to Columbia, I think that everybody is surprised with the different types of activities because there's so many different things that all come together and work together. Columbia is what we call a very eclectic community. It's a vibrant college town. It has a lot of activities that you would think would go along with the educational facilities. We also have a lot of medical facilities there. But our downtown and our outlying areas offer things such as we have 5 microbreweries, a couple distilleries, a lot of very fun bars, chef-owned restaurants, a lot of art galleries, very many artisans there. We have a very strong art community. And the music scene is something that we're also very proud of and have a lot of different ways to promote it.
I love the name, the True False Film Festival. Sounds kind of political. Please tell.
Well, you know what, Dan? I suppose it could be considered that, but I will also tell you that our films that we show at the True False Film Festival are entertaining, they're engaging, they're very interesting. Some are very lighthearted, but I will also tell you that the True False Film Festival producers do not shy away from topics that might be controversial or might be a little uncomfortable. But I will just tell you that the people that started this film festival, I think back in, it was 2004, because in 2003, a lot of light bulbs started going off and documentary film festivals really became very well known, and they started becoming very popular. So I think when two gentlemen who are filmmakers and artisans and very much involved in the creative scene came up with the idea to create this film festival, I think the timing is right. They were in the right place at the right time. They knew what they were doing. And the True False Film Festival is world-renowned. It has been named one of the coolest film festivals in the world. We have films that the filmmakers come in from throughout the world to accompany their film, and they may bring with them some of the subjects that are discussed in the people that are discussed in the documentaries. And so everything just kind of all works together. We've got the filmmakers coming in, and in some cases it could be a world premiere, but many, many of our films that we debut at True False have actually come straight from the Sundance Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
As a fan of Katy Tour, I love the Katy Trail State Park. What's that?
Well, I would like to know if you're on first-name basis with Katy Tour, because if you are, then we should invite her to come and experience the Katy Trail. The Katy Trail State Park is the skinniest state park in Missouri. It stretches 240 miles from St. Louis, almost all the way to Kansas City. It ends in Clinton, but we've also just recently built a spur that will be taking us all the way into Kansas City. So for people that like to hike, bike, and there are even some sections of the trail that are equestrian friendly, and I might also add that the trail is pet friendly. So when you come to mid-Missouri, and if you come to Columbia, you have the opportunity to get on the MKT Spur, which is a wellness and nature 9-mile, very, very scenic trail that you can hike or bike and get out to the Katy Trail. So the Katy Trail is, it's something that started, I don't know exactly how many years ago, but it is something that people come from all over to do, whether they come to Columbia or go to Rocheport for different celebrations, activities. If there's celebrations going on at the different colleges and at the university, everybody at one time or another find themselves out in Rocheport, or they are coming and they're wanting to ride the Katy Trail. So.
Okay,
it's
I'm
a
also a huge fan
do.
Of Ozark, and I know Lake of the Ozarks isn't as crazy as the Netflix series. I knew it was great for swimming, sunning, and boating, but didn't know it's also great for golf. So real quickly, what's the Ozarks Golf Trail?
Well, the Lake of the Ozarks Golf Trail is made up of 13 different courses. The designers of our golf courses range from people such as Arnold Palmer, Tom Weisskopf, and other well-known golfers, and I know we're kind of in a hurry trying to speed this along, but the golf courses are exquisite. They're amazing. They're affordable. The scenery is beautiful. People can play golf in their own hometowns, but there's not that many places where you can go and have the backdrop of your golf course to be a beautiful 54,000-acre lake. Another very interesting fact is that the Lake of the Ozarks was named the top recreational lake in the nation by the readers of USA Today, and I have to think that one of the reasons that the recreational opportunity that the lake area provides is because of golf. We are a golfing destination. We book golf packages, and people can, and we play golf really about 10 months out of the year.
Okay, less than 2 minutes to go. Go ahead, Mary Ellen.
Rocheport. 250 people population and several fine dining restaurants. How?
Okay, well, you're saying how does this happen? Let me just tell you, first of all, in Rocheport, and I did mention it just a little earlier, so I'm glad you brought it back up again, but we have one of the most beautiful and award-winning wineries in Rocheport, and it overlooks the Missouri River. We have the Bluff Top Bistro, which is operated by the Le Bourgeois Winery. We also have the A-Frame Restaurant, which overlooks the Missouri River, and it is operated
by the
Le Bourgeois Winery. We have a lovely restaurant in the downtown area of Rocheport, and it is called Abigail's, and they provide just a menu that you wouldn't expect to find in this little bitty town of Rocheport. And also, Rocheport was the first community. Everything weaves together here.
Marjorie, I'm sorry, I've
got to
move on. I don't have time. I do not have time. How do our listeners learn more about beautiful mid-Missouri and its many attractions?
If people want to find out about this, I'm going to give them an easy way out. Go to visitmo.com, and they can get information on all of my destinations and everything throughout the state.
Okay, thank you to Marjorie Benders, Tony Mua, Sue Presby, Barbara Golden, and Doug McKenzie for appearing on the 400th episode of Travel It's Radio. Next week, our guest will be New York publicist Alice Marshall of Alice Marshall Associates. Now, this is Dan Schlossberg, along with Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee, saying thank you for your time this time. Until next time, stay safe and good night.
Where's the phone? Here.